I'll just do a short introduction about what I think this event is about. Because poets have always protested. Shelley did in The Mask of Anarchy, his protest about the Peterloo Massacre. Bob Dylan did in The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, where he lamented the murder of a black barmaid by a white man. Siegfried Sassoon did in Suicide in the Trenches, expressing his anger at the horrors of the First World War and the death of friends in the trenches. And more recently, there are plenty of examples, poetry in Tiananmen Square, in Tahrir Square, Pussy Riot in Moscow. The list is endless. English Pen, of which Joe Glanville on my left is the director, is a very important organisation. It's the centre of a worldwide writers, and many of you may know it, worldwide writers association with 145 centres in more than 100 countries. They defend writers and readers around the world whose right to freedom of expression is at risk. They celebrate writing of merit and courage, and in the past they've supported writers as Václav Havel, Jack Mpanji, Taslima Nasreen, Liu Xiaobo, Wole Soyinka, Ino Meomese in Cameroon, Mohamed Al Ajami in Qatar, Nguyen Xuan Gia in Vietnam. And they're just a few of the hundreds and over the years, thousands of the most recent victims of censorship Penn has worked for. Because poets have always been censored, censors, in a way, bear witness to the power of the word, perhaps even more forcefully than the writers and readers they consider dangerous. Censors imprison, torture, kill, banish, oppress. They deny writers the paper to write on, audience to be influenced, jobs to allow them to survive. They create a climate in which readers become afraid to search out dangerous books. And, of course, writers censor themselves. Authoritarian governments, fundamentalists, nationalists, monopoly owners, all of them at various points try to silence discussion. You'd be surprised how much silencing discussion surreptitiously goes on in this country, let alone others, on matters of religion, on the role of women, the status of immigrants, homosexuality, the exploitation of children, anything which threatens their power. For the censor, it's a never-ending list. This is the first time that Ledbury Poetry Festival has partnered English Pen, and we're extremely proud of the partnership, and we plan to work with them every year to bring to people's notice in a variety of different ways, highlighting the fact that there are poets all around the world who courageously stand up to tyranny and censorship and are often punished for it. So our panel today is Joe Glanville, on my left, who's the director of English Pen. Before joining Pen, she was an award-winning editor of Index on Censorship, which is a magazine that, before Joe came, that I worked for, and I'm very proud to say I hired her. That was one of the best things I ever did. And a BBC current affairs producer. She appears regularly in the media as a commentator on culture and freedom of expression. George Surtees, on the far end, was born in Budapest and came to England as a refugee at the age of 8. His poems began appearing in 1973, and his first book was published in 1979. He has many collections and won the T.S. Eliot Prize for Real in 2005. He's worked extensively as a translator, is himself translated into several languages, and has publicly defended poetry as an art form. And he wrote the introduction to Catechism, Poems for Pussy Riot, which you'll hear more about later, written in support of the imprisoned members of the group in Russia. Our third member of the panel is Josh Ekroy. And Sabrina Mahfouz was not able to come because her baby is ill. And Josh has wonderfully stepped in, very much at the last minute, so much so that I haven't had time to do research on his life. So I'm going to read what he says about himself, because he says it much better. John Ekroy was born in Essex, brought up in Surrey, and educated in Sussex and Kentish Town. In another life, he wrote novels for which the world was not yet ready, as well as humorous articles which appeared in magazines, including Punch. He now lives next to a lot of building sites in the City of London. He taught English for some years, mainly in FE colleges, and for 2 years in Kiribati in the Pacific, which was then and is now disappearing beneath the waves as ocean levels rise. His poems appear in magazines, anthologies, and webzines. Ways to Build a Roadblock is his first collection. And I should explain that, in a way, what Joe is going to talk about and what George is going to talk about is fairly self-explanatory. And so, in a way, is Josh. But Josh writes poems about wars and modern warfare and the legacy of them. And many of them are about the British official attitude and behaviour in these wars. So though he's not an imprisoned poet, he thinks a great deal about all the issues around wars in our time. So I think the format is going to be that I will ask the panel questions, and in the course of it, Josh and George are going to read a poem each from their own collections. But meanwhile, this is going to be a discussion in which I'm hoping that I'll ask a question and then it will all be left to you three. Okay, so I wanted to start by saying... Has it got switched off? Can you hear? Okay. Saul Bellow said in his novel Humboldt's Gift, "Orpheus moved stones and trees, but a poet can't even perform a hysterectomy. Miracle and power no longer belong to him." So I wanted to ask you all, is poetry relevant for protest? Is it better than just shouting from the rooftops, and why?
Okay, I'll start. Depends where you are. Depends when you are. Depends what the situation is. There are situations in which poems are very important. Up till 1989 and the change of system, poems in Eastern Europe were very important. They were part of the way that society and culture asserted its independence, asserted its differences from what the official line was. After that, less so. One of my conversations back in 1991, shortly after the major changes of 89, which we saw from within Hungary, in fact, a rather marvellous older Hungarian poet, István Vas, said, you know, when people don't have shoes, they need poems. Once they have shoes, they don't think they need them quite so much. And I think there is something in it, because that's exactly what happened pre-89 and to some degree after. Just one extra thing. I received a little pamphlet from India, from an Indian friend, about a year ago, whose title was "All Poetry is Protest." Discuss.
I wish I'd had a chance to see that.
I think Saul Bellow must have been in a particularly dyspeptic mood about the uselessness of artists when he wrote that paragraph. But I think what we see from some of the poets at risk whose poems are being read out at Ledbury, which has been really, really amazing to hear, and you'll hear some of them at the end of our discussion, what we see is that poets are dangerous, that writers in general are dangerous, and that's why they are still put in prison. So Pussy Riot, which has been mentioned, and Penn was very active with Pussy Riot, and we put together this anthology of poems written by poets, and it was really using poetry to protest, and George wrote a fabulous introduction to that anthology. Ali Smith was one of the poets who contributed to it. And there you have an example. It was punk prayer that they performed, and they were thrown in jail on grounds of hooliganism. There's another poet who I hope you'll get a chance to hear at the end of today, an Egyptian poet, very well known in Egypt, He's not in prison for his poetry, but he has fallen foul of a new law in Egypt, where it is illegal to protest without permission. And he was protesting outside the jail where the murderers of Khaled Syed, who was beaten to death by the police, were being tried, and he's now serving a 2-year prison sentence. It's about the power of dissent, and what a government wants to do to control its people is to silence dissent, to silence anyone who disagrees. And so while poets may not, thank the Lord, be able to do hysterectomies, they can make trouble, and governments are frightened of them.
Yeah, well, talking of hysterectomies, I mean, the first thing that happens when we are born is that we protest. And I think that one of the things that poets do is to try and rediscover that power of protestation that has been removed from them by parents in school who said, you must stop protesting or I won't give you a sweetie. And so we stop. And so we have to rediscover that power. And it dismays me quite a lot, actually. Not that I'm a saint in terms of, you know, I've been on protest marches, but temperamentally, I'm not really suited to that. I'm temperamentally more inclined to sit at a desk and try and think of ways in which I can satirize the latest political statement, which has revealed the crass political manoeuvring of an individual who is trying to control us all. And poetry has the power, it frightens politicians, both British and any other nationality, is because it has a power to make us think in fresh ways. And that's what poetry should do. It should make us think in fresh ways. And when we start to do that, then we start to question what's going on up there.
And more than prose, poetry more than prose.
Yes.
I was going to say, actually, if you think about it, it's the perfect vehicle for protest. Because when you protest, if you're thinking about a traditional protest, you're marching. When you're marching, you're in a rhythm. And one of the things anyone here who's been on a demonstration will know, people start chanting. So I think it comes out of protest in a natural way, as well as being, as you say, the first thing we do when we appear in this
world. And it's condensed as well. It's very condensed.
The other thing is a bad guy's chant too.
It's true. This is true. But that's propaganda.
They're also chanting.
Well, they can be poets too.
Well, indeed they can.
Are they?
Well, I was reading an article, I think it was a New Yorker, about 10 days ago, about a poetry of ISIS or Daesh, whatever you want to call them.
Right.
They're very big on poetry.
Right.
They're very big on particular kind of romantic poetry. It's about the scripture-based poetry.
Right.
So poetry can be in the service of all these things. What I wanted to sort of just say about, discuss rather facetiously, but about all poetry's protest, to me it seems that insofar as poetry is an assertion of the freedoms of the imagination, and a freedom of language, it is in itself a protest. The assertion of the human imagination as independent of all those factors that would control it, I think is one of the key aspects of poetry. In the 19th century, during the Romantic period, when the 1848 period, when everybody was rising, a lot of those poets were actually active revolutionaries. On the Hungarian side, Sándor Petőfi, who died at the age of 26 in battle, he triggered the revolution of 1848 by reciting a poem from the steps of the newly built National Museum. That's what I meant by there are moments. There are particular times when it's like a very dry fire. You light it, and it's there.
What do you think the issues in today's world are that might require a poet to protest, and have they changed over the past two decades or so? Josh?
Well, I think there's been a bit of a shift in the last 15 years. I mean, I spent some time abroad. When I got back in 2003, the Iraq War was just starting. And it was no coincidence, I think, that I then began to write. I didn't realise what I was doing. I think, to answer your question, yes, I think there has been a shift. I think there's been a sort of acceptance that somehow under Blair, the UK has... The UK, perhaps always, I don't know, but particularly under Blair, has a sort of sense that it has a right to go in and sort things out. And I'm not quite sure where this right comes from, you know. And when that march occurred in 2003, not in my name and all that, the Labour government at the time, the new Labour government at the time, was scared to its socks. To put it politely, when Tony Blair's attention was drawn to that protest. So I think there has been a shift, and I think that it's been to do with the fact that we've become less and less politicised. I don't know whether I'm thumping a tub here, or tub thumping, whatever it is. I think that what is happening is that there's a sort of suggestion that it's going to happen no matter what, and I think that's quite dangerous. And I think that poets have a kind of duty to try to counteract that if possible.
The first protest poem I remember hearing, I think, was 1967. It was at the National Theatre. I mentioned this in the essay which I wrote for Penn. It was in a show called Us, or US. If you like, which was about Vietnam, and Adrian Mitchell was reading his anti-Vietnam poem, Tell Me Lies About Vietnam. Some of you may very well remember that. It was a very powerful piece of polemic. So poetry as polemic, I think, works very well. As I said, there's a Horst Wessel song, which also does polemic, and which also united people. So in a way, there's a... I think one of the things that one is always struggling with, or I struggle with anyway, is the keepsake, that we hate poetry that has a palpable design upon us. So something in which you know you're supposed to agree, and you go ahead and agree, and I'm sure I could say many things right now here, which you would agree with, and we could all feel pretty good about that, is that there's something inside one, there's a rebellious side inside one, which is a very valuable thing, which resists that too, which hence the idea of all poetry is protest. Mm. That there's somewhere at the heart of this thing, particularly, I think, in poetry, because it doesn't spell things out, it doesn't completely develop its narratives. Mm. It goes to core feelings, which are sometimes very complex feelings, partly because of that, that act of resistance is right at the heart of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I should say that I think one of the exciting things now is that you do have this whole young generation of spoken word poets emerging, of poetry as performance, hip hop, obviously, which channels a lot of social commentary, political commentary.
Yeah. And is funny as well.
And
humour is huge in protests, isn't it? Everyone knows that dictators hate being laughed at.
I think laughter, skill, simply saying I disagree with this, that's a statement. But I think protest poetry is at its most powerful when it's witty, when it has a kind of grace about it, when it has a kind of humour, where it has a kind of particular savagery, all of these things. It's like the art of the great political cartoonists. The great political cartoonists are brilliant draftsmen.
Can I ask you to what extent has poetry as protest been part of your own experience?
Well, I grew up with the Vietnam period. That's when I was 17, 18, 19-year-old. And there's much since. I will read one of my own poems, which sort of demonstrate how I kind of feel about this. My current home country has a government which I think is pretty loathsome. And I've written against it, but in articles, newspapers and magazines and so forth. And I have written against them. I feel quite clearly I know what I'm up against there. So there's that. There's an attempt basically to read quite a lot of Europe, I think, back into the 30s, back into that kind of attitude, back into an authoritarian fascist attitude. So I think that's to be fought. But of course there are many other things, and you've already mentioned them. Pussy Riot was essentially focused on the activities and the arrest of a particular group. But beyond that, it was about, again, about the way an authoritarian state tries to determine expression and its effect of resistance.
Yeah. Would you like to read when your poetry, and then Josh can talk about your involvement in poetry.
I'll stand up to do this. So this is what I mean. This is a poem called Cargo. You can work at the subject matter yourselves at leisure. Consider the drowned packing the sea and rising like a dank mountain, crowding the water, packed close like cargo, the drowned vanish unlisted. How deep the sea is, how fierce and cold, untroubled in its history. We have history in which we drown our sorrows as in salt water. We don't understand death in the way the sea does. We set out in hope. Now we lie piled up as if we were intended to be together. But nothing is meant. The sea does not bear meaning. It is just a throat. We too have our throats, but they are filled with water and grief and money. Those who ferry us betray us. We can't trust them, but rely on them. You will recall us in your private drowned moments. You will recall us.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Josh, this is your first collection. Does that mean you came to poetry and protest poetry late? Would you call this a poetry protest collection?
Yes, I would, actually. I think...
it's called Ways to Build a Roadblock.
Yeah. When I was at school, I think I was trying to find ways to protest against authority. I wasn't very good at it. And then gradually, as time went on, I found myself... You know the way school children do, they imitate teachers, and I just sort of went on along doing that, only it was with politicians. And that amused me, and I did it for laughs. And then I sort of went, it was only when I came to write poetry that I wrote about other things as well, and began to feel that there was something, not serious, but something serious, that had to be taken seriously. And I think that liberated me to try and write satirical poetry in a way which was new. As I say, I didn't realise it was happening, but in 2003 I started to write about what was going on in the news. I'd pick up a newspaper and I'd hear a voice in my head, some lieutenant commander barking at the troops or something, and I'd start to write and try and reproduce that voice. A lot of the stuff that I write is through masks, through voices of other people. Mm. I'll read a poem which exploits that. And that's what I do, because that's all I can do, really, I think.
I mean, Hungary has a history for us all, and living now about a protest. It was firstly under communism, and then now, as you say, and at various other points after communism, having a very right-wing government. And so, in a sense, my feeling is that protest in Hungary would be seen as a normal thing in writing, while I feel my own feeling about England is There isn't really a tradition.
Well,
there's a historical tradition, which I'm going to come to. I'm thinking about now.
It has to do with the edge that risk gives you. I'm not going to be arrested for whatever I write on the whole. I could submit myself, and this is how letter communism worked. It worked by self-censorship, which is something you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
So you kind of knew what you could do and what you couldn't do, and towards the latter days of communism in the 1980s, you could write just about anything, providing you didn't mention three things. You didn't mention the presence of Russian troops in the country. You didn't mention 1956, the revolution. You didn't mention unemployment, which existed, but it didn't exist officially. So there were, and you can still write about birds, you can write about the moon, you can write about almost anything you like. So the way that protest worked under those circumstances, there was one particular poet called George Petri, who was a very highly acclaimed poet who decided to go Samizdat. He refused to be published. So he went underground, and actually his work vanished into public hands very, very quickly. So he became an important political factor. This may be the fact to refer to this 56 poem. I'll just read a few verses from it. It's a very long poem. It's called One Sentence About Tyranny, but it's a hell of a long sentence. by a man called Gyula Ilyich, who wrote this poem, as they used to say then, for the study drawer, for the desk drawer, because he knew it couldn't be published. But then it was surreptitiously published. And it's about, essentially about a police state. And I think what's rather marvellous about it is actually his drive, his momentum, all those sort of things which you could get from anything else, but here it's driven by protest, which I think is very important. I'll read you just four or five quatrains from it. Okay? Where tyranny exists, that tyranny exists, not only in the barrel of the gun, not only in the cells of the prison, not just in the interrogation block or the small hours of the clock, the guard's bark and his fists. The tyranny exists not just in the billowing black theatre of the closing speech of the prosecutor, in the justified use of force, the prisoner's dull morse, not merely in the cool postscript of the expected verdict. This tyranny, not just in the crisp military order to stand, and the numb instruction fire, the roll of the drum, in the last twitch of the corpse in the ditch, not just in the door half open, and the fearful omen, the whispered tremor of the secret rumour, the hand that grips the finger before the lips, tyranny in place in the iron mask of the face. And then he goes through and he says, it works, doesn't just work when you break laws. Right. It's there, it governs your behaviour at every level.
Yeah.
I would just say what you were saying earlier. I would say that there was a very strong line that has continued of poets in this country who protest, engage with politics, whether it's Adrian Mitchell, who George mentioned earlier, or Tony Harrison, Caroline Duffy has been very political, and then all the great poets of Northern Ireland, Seamus Heaney, many, many others.
That's true.
So I do feel it's
alive. That's true. And also, I think satires, I think the English are good at satire. Would you read us a poem, Josh, from your collection? Yeah, you're right.
You may remember that there was a gentleman called Lord Hutton who wrote a report on the death of Dr. David Kelly, who may or may not have committed suicide, when he realised that the information that he'd given was going to be used to compile a dossier which might have been less than the truth. And when Lord Hutton reported, he found that the government was completely to be exonerated. So I wrote a poem called Lord Hutton Reports, and it was going to be on the death of Humpty Dumpty. I am satisfied that this is not a case in which the Crown could have had any knowledge that a notoriously unstable egg would hurl itself from the wall it was ill-advised enough to sit on. I am further satisfied that subconsciously the King's horses, and indeed the King's men, may have wished to reassure the Crown that the position of Mr. Dalty was perfectly safe. But there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever to suggest that the so-called Dumpty dossier, now in the public domain, overstressed the stability of the egg's position in any particular. Turning now to Miss Liddell, who obtained an interview from Mr. Dumpty, which he was not authorised to give, just prior to his fall. The vast bulk of the evidence laid before me states categorically that it was this very interview that destabilised him. For years a loyal servant of the royal household, this extremely able ovoid was put under intolerable pressure, in particular by Miss Liddell's persistent and intrusive line of questioning. Clearly, much needs to be done in refining procedures for press interviews with leaking eggs. In conclusion, the cavalry is to be commended for its efforts, which went way beyond its duty of care, to reassemble Mr. Dumpty.
To ask you, Joe, to talk a little bit about the work you do at English Pen, and to what extent you use poets as a form of advocacy, and what indeed do poets feel about it? I remember when I was working at Index, I did meet poets who wrote protest poetry and longed not to, just felt that they were in a position where they couldn't not, but they would have loved to have not had that.
Well, I suppose it works in two different ways at Penn. I mean, one of the great things for Penn is that we have a very large membership of writers, including poets and translators and editors and publishers and people who love writing and reading but may not be published themselves. And that for us in the human rights work we do is one of our greatest tools, really, of advocacy, because it means where most human rights groups can protest, can write a letter to the government, it's a matter of principle. For us, it's not just a matter of principle, it's about our lifeblood, it's about our profession, it's about what we believe in. And so when you've got some outrage happening somewhere, or it could be an outrage that could be happening in this country, so, for example, we're still campaigning to change the libel laws in Northern Ireland. We've successfully changed them in England and Wales, but Northern Ireland and Scotland, they still haven't been changed. So we asked all the leading writers in Northern Ireland, and some from Ireland, to sign a letter to the leaders of the executive at Stormont. And that's a powerful thing when you have Paul Muldoon and Roddy Doyle and, you know, all those great writers. So that's, in general, a great form of advocacy. But in terms of poetry, which has been really quite powerful, I've already talked about Pussy Riot, where it's doing something slightly different. It's not dealing necessarily with the poem that caused the trouble and the poem that led to those protesters being in jail. It's actually turning to writers and saying, can you do something creative as a form of protest? And what was really wonderful, in fact, this lovely piece that George wrote for our website about leading up to this event today about protest, and quoted a wonderful haiku from the book, is the variety of poetry that was produced was incredibly imaginative. And so it didn't feel that any of those poets who responded were being squeezed into a protest box, but they were responding imaginatively. And in the case of another instance where we've used poetry as advocacy, another of our very long-running cases is a Cameroonian poet called Ino Mayemese, who's just been released from jail. He's also a political activist, and he was clearly jailed for his political activism, and his poetry was obviously an expression of his political activism. And what we did there, and this has been led by our very brilliant campaigns manager, Kat Lucas, we went out to translators on social media and said, you know, translators, he writes in French, saying, translators out there, would you translate one of his poems? And we had a fantastic response, and so we sort of crowd-translated Ino Mayemese's poems, and then we published it as a print-on-demand book. So that was a way that we used, again, we used his poetry as advocacy for his case, but we were able to bring in all the translators who support us to be part of that. So I think for us it's been a very exciting way of campaigning, because it's creative, it engages our members and supporters in a creative way, but it's not, I think, sort of squeezing them to boxes where they may not be comfortable.
And presumably you believe that this writing of protest poetry changes people's minds.
Well, I think it's a hard thing to prove, isn't it?
And it is, very.
When one of the most successful campaigns I've been involved with, which was actually when I was still at Index on Censorship, was when a now very well-known Canadian-Iranian journalist was arrested, thrown into Evin prison in 2009 because he'd been covering the elections, which you'll remember in Iran, resulted in this extraordinary uprising, green uprising. And there was an extraordinary international campaign for him, and he ended up getting released. And I have my reasons for thinking why he was released. He had some very, very, very powerful, very well-connected people campaigning for him. But you never quite know what makes a difference. And what we do know, though, is that you have to keep shouting, and that I also know from writers who've been in prison that when they come out, they say, hearing, when if it filters through to them, that someone outside is fighting for them.
Yeah.
If they get a letter, it's a lifeline. Because one of the things that your jailer will do, I think it's a classic form of destroying someone, is to say, you are forgotten.
You are nobody.
No one cares. Yeah. You don't exist. Yeah. Because part of torture is to destroy someone's personality and dignity. Yeah. So in the end, you know, even when someone does get released, you can never be quite sure,
you can't be sure
how big a role you played, but you know that it's really needed.
I mean, Jack Mpanji once described to me being in prison in Malawi, and the jailers started saying, you get so much post. And these letters were pouring in. And actually, they made a huge impact on the people who worked in the prison anyway, because they couldn't believe that someone, in other words, they failed to isolate him.
But what I would say is that in campaigning here, I really can see the difference. And so with the libel reform campaign, where we had 60,000 supporters, and there was a moment when it took us 4 years to get the law changed, and there was a moment when the whole libel fight got tangled up with the press regulation fight, and David Putnam, God bless him, tried to bring the whole thing to a halt. And we just deployed all of our most famous writers, from Salman Rushdie to David Hare, with letters published in the papers. And there is no doubt that that helped.
That made a difference.
So can see it make a difference.
There's an interesting sort of movement which, no doubt, many of you will have received from organisations like AVAS and so forth.
Yes.
So in effect, there's quite a lot of activism, which is effective, because once a certain number of actually people sign that, then people are obliged to take notice.
They don't always, they do that. I mean, as with the, for example, obviously in the case of the campaigning for the government to act, it's a much more difficult case, but to act after Edward Snowden's leaks and to give the intelligence services less freedom to gather our data. Obviously, that's much more complicated. And obviously, with the Iraq war, I mean, That's a great example of an extraordinary march. I don't know if there'd been as big a march since the Suez crisis.
Miners' strike, there were.
Was there? Okay. So it doesn't always make a difference.
No, I was pointing at technology now offers you.
It does.
Yes. But I mean, what I want to talk, I want to ask Josh maybe and George. I mean, there are countries, and I imagine Hungary is one of them, where it's a tradition, as it is not in this country, for intellectuals to write poetry, and where poetry is much more part of private ordinary life, not private life, but ordinary life, community life, family life, etc. And I just wondered, I was wondering if you felt the efficacy of poetry in a country like England where that isn't true. I mean, you don't expect a George Osborne to get around to writing a poem, though I may be wrong.
He's meant to be the most cultured member of the cabinet.
Well, he is the most cultured, but that's not saying a lot.
Yes, I mean, I worry a little bit about what George was saying earlier about here we all are in the room agreeing. I feel that there is a question how, you know, I don't have a message, you know, which I want to get out. Mm. You know, I don't want to stand on a soapbox. Should I want to? Or your question about the family. I mean, I do remember reading my sister said, oh, Josh has got a poem he wants to read. What? Oh, all right, if you insist. It's a bit like that. And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I think there is a sort of reticence amongst poets. You know, poets as a breed are reticent.
But not everywhere in Britain.
Well, reticence is a British condition.
It's a British condition. Exactly.
I'm reticent myself.
Exactly. So is there reticence in Hungary? I mean, would poetry be seen as a perfectly ordinary way to communicate?
There are several factors in this. One is that people, it was a fairly oral culture, so people did learn an awful lot of poems by heart. Yeah. My parents, although they were far from literary people, they knew the poems that they had learned, so it was natural. There's a very interesting thing also about pressure. This is the famous Akhmatova thing, you know. Can you describe this? Somebody asks her in the queue, and she says, yes, I can. You can orally memorize things. You can keep things in there, and it can't be censored there.
Yeah.
If you've kept it there once, so that... But that requires a certain sort of pressure, and it requires, I think... I just want to just add something to what Joe said about the shouting. Because one of the cases I make in my piece for you is that there's dancing. One of the lovely things about the piece that Josh read, it's dancing too. It's witty, it's funny, it holds itself together, it's a beautifully made thing. And it has to be that as well. Mm. The shouting has to be there, not necessarily in poetry, it has to be there in terms so you write letters, so you march, so you argue, so you get up, you write articles, you get up on street corners. That would have been the role of intellectuals, I think, in Eastern Europe. Mm. I'm not so sure about it now. I think, in a way, one of the aspects of globalization has been to diminish the importance of the intellectual. Because powers move out beyond the local. So that's something I think we are in the position of having to struggle with.
Yeah.
Well, I think in China, I think it is still, for an intellectual, that you write poetry is part of what you do.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Tiananmen Square earlier, and famously poems were stuck up all around Tiananmen Square. Mm. Yu Xiaobo is a poet. I think you mentioned Isis as well, using poetry. And again, poetry is deeply, deeply part of Arab culture. So I think there's in Vietnam as well. So I do think there are other cultures where an educated person, a person who could consider themselves an intellectual, would write poetry in a way that might have died to some extent here.
Well, what we've got here is song.
Which one could call poetry,
yes.
Actually. And I think, interesting enough, you know, since when I was growing up, when there was nothing, no such thing, there was Frank Sinatra, since the Beatles, those songs where protest is built into, Eleanor Rigby and things, you know, were completely alien in my childhood.
And you think, obviously, folk music and blues, which is folk music, blues is quintessentially protest, isn't it?
Yeah. You've told us the story about whether your family reads poetry together. I couldn't understand how ambivalent that was. Did your family read poetry? And together, aloud, to each other?
No.
So when your sister said, read a poem...
It was it's a poem from the blues.
What about when you were a child, George? Did they read your rhymes?
Oh, yes, verses? Yeah.
And that stops at a certain point.
Yes.
And what about...
That's for kids.
Yes, yes. And what in a country like yours... Especially under communism, would poetry be something you'd talk about and read at home at night in families?
One of the texts that was, to some degree. But as I said, my family, I don't come from a sort of highbrow family.
No, I didn't mean they have to be.
But yes, in a sense that they know their poetry, they know a great deal of it. And one of the interesting things was when we came here, a text that was smuggled out to us. Was a famous translation into Hungarian of Villon, Grand Testament. Yeah. That was smuggled out. It had to be smuggled out. It was on blue carbon paper, which we received. It was smuggled out because it wasn't allowed to be published, because it was read as counter-propaganda. It wasn't, and to some degree it was. To some degree, I think there was a conscious awareness that here's somebody doing something, just translating something. May I give you one other example of this? The same poet, Ishvan Vash, who was silenced. It's what happened to people after 1948, 49 particularly. A whole generation of silenced, just couldn't publish, some were thrown into jail and so forth. And he wrote, slightly afterwards, this thing called a translator's vote of thanks, in which he thanks those people who he had translated, because in their translation he could say what he sort of wanted. So it had to be brought in. And that was its value, that was its great power.
Yeah. Yes. So do you think the way that poetry is treated, I suppose what I'm trying to get at, is seen in the country as something that's normal and ordinary and part of daily life, has an impact on the kind of poetry that people write?
Well, I don't think... What there was after 1990, I actually put together an anthology of young Hungarian poets who grew to maturity after 1989. I was interested in what they were doing, and there was a retreat from politics. And they were absolutely sick of it. They were absolutely sick of the rhetoric associated with it.
Yeah.
That will slowly begin to change again, I think. But there was this withdrawal into personal experience, very beautifully articulated personal experience.
Right, right. That was post-communist.
Post-communist. Well, you know, communism in Hungary had practically fallen apart by the time it actually did fall apart. But there was... There's a language of politics which people grow to loathe. So even to go near it, I think, they just thought, it's contaminated. You can't do with this stuff. So they retreated. I think it's a temporary condition. And I think currently, under the current government, I think you get quite a lot of resistance at that sort of level.
Yeah.
But natural poetry... Poetry is ancient. Poetry is as old as speech. There are two major literary forms, poetry and storytelling. Mm. They've always been with us. They're with us. They will be with us when we die. It will outlive us all, because it's much, much older.
Mm.
And in itself, like the little Indian pamphlet says, it is a form of resistance, it's a form of keeping language usable and alive.
And Josh, you came reasonably late to poetry. Were you writing poetry before this collection? Or was it the wars and the horrors and the way British policy that drove you to poetry? And why poetry?
Good question. I mean, I did the usual teenage thing, but that sort of fizzled out as soon as I started doing a degree, and that sort of beats it out of you. I think it was being abroad, actually, that started me off. I was in the middle of the Pacific on an atoll and teaching, and I don't know, I just started writing then, and gradually, without my really realising it, it became political after I got back.
And you started writing poetry from nowhere? You'd never written it before?
Well, as I say.
As a teenager, yeah. Joe, before we want to... You're going to read, you're all going to read a poem from Writers at Risk or in prison. But before that, is there solidarity amongst poets as far as protest is concerned? When you're doing your work in pen, do you feel that people support each other across national boundaries?
Yeah, I mean, I found it incredibly moving this weekend seeing Josh read a poem yesterday that he's going to read again today. Simon Armitage read a poem. Salima Hill. Each read a... We basically invited poets across Ledbury, with Ledbury's help, to read a poem by a poet who's in prison. And Joe Bell did one as well. And it was even more powerful than I expected it to be. Because poets know how to read. You know how to read your poems. And poets are performers. And there is something about the ritual, I think, of a poet standing up and delivering their poem to an audience. And so when that poet stands up and reads another poet's voice, there was something incredibly powerful about that. So that's an act of solidarity. And Jo Bell has already said to me that she wants to develop a relationship with the poet whose poem she read. And we also have this annual award that's in memory of Harold Pinter, called the Pen Pinter Award, where a very celebrated British writer, this year it's James Fenton, who is a poet, as you all know, and he gets his award in October, and we are giving James Fenton, as we do every year, for whoever wins the prize, a list of cases, of pen cases, and he will choose one of those cases to share the prize with. And last year it was a Syrian activist called Mazen Darwish, who is still in jail in Syria, who is being tortured. And in very difficult circumstances, he smuggled out an extraordinary letter in which he basically forgave Salman Rushdie for the satanic verses, and basically said, "We in the Arab world should be ashamed for our response." So, I think it's there is a very, very moving solidarity, and I think that as I was saying earlier, that because freedom of expression goes to the core, obviously, of what writers do, and without it, they can't be published. Or they may be actually chilled from even writing in certain circumstances. I think writers who are individual solitary beasts, they do form a herd when they need to.
I'm glad. Right, well, could we have these three poems now? These are now poems by... Are they all in prison, or are they at risk?
I think the ones you're reading are either in prison or under house arrest, and certainly, yes, prison or house arrest.
So do you want to start, George?
Sure. This one's under strict surveillance. Her name's Zaydin Bouzer, this is her poem. A sheet of paper can become a knife. A sheet of paper can become a knife. A rather sharp one, too. I was only turning a page when the ring finger of my right hand got sliced at the knuckle. Though small, the sudden wound oozed blood, a thread as fine as silk, and stung a little. Startling transformation from paper into knife. There must have been some mistake, and some kind of turning point. This ordinary paper, a chill of awe. She was Tibetan, by the way, I should have said.
Mm-hmm. Mavash Sabet is an Iranian currently serving a 20-year prison sentence for being a member of the Baha'i faith. She's not young, and she is at present incarcerated in one of the most brutal prisons in Iran. This poem, Hope, Hello Again, has been adopted from the Persian by Bahia Nakhjavani, based on a translation by Violet and Ali Nakhjavani. Hello again. Last night, in the midst of unsettled darkness, I found myself at the axis of the earth for a moment, holding it taut between my outstretched arms. And as I struggled to keep those frozen poles apart, I saw I could prepare these icy limbs and melt them wondrously between my two hot palms. So there I stood on the summit of the loftiest peak, a simple woman, glowing with love again, ready to salute the world once more.
I'm going to read you an extract from a poem by Omar Hazek. And he's the poet I was telling you about earlier, who is serving a 2-year prison sentence for protesting without permission. This is an extract from I Run With The Sea. I run with the sea. I outstrip it. It outstrips me. The full moon laughs. Words take flight from my mouth to play in the sand, mix up the letters and scatter their names. However, the stride of the sea is bigger. My heart is small and trembles like the eyes of birds. The sea wave toys with my words. Its stride lengthens through my letters, teaching them how to catch a squirrel in the branches of rhymes, how to splash water over a child. It outstrips me. The full moon's laughter grows. O sea, my heart is small, but it holds a procession of lovers and a song that in you found not its harbour.
Well, I must say, having heard the whole panel discussion, but especially hearing those poems, I'm so very, very pleased that Ledbury's going to be working with Penn, hopefully forever, bringing these voices, because there's something extraordinary about hearing the voices of these people in these terrible places. So I just wanted to say thank you to all three of you for a very, very interesting conversation. Thank you.